The weapons upgrade program, dominated by its band of free thinkers, was dramatic in more ways than one. The tinkerers turned out to be wildly productive, in large part because they weren't restrained by any of the normal bureaucratic controls. But the downside of this freedom became painfully evident early on, when a freelance tinkerer on his way to Charlie's office to demonstrate a weapon he had designed blew up a Texaco gas station not far from the Capitol. For a moment, it looked as though the incident might bring down the entire operation. The man responsible was one of Vaughn Forrest's protégés, Colonel Bill Dilger, a retired Air Force pilot with 200 missions over Vietnam. Dilger had flown an A-10 air-to-ground support plane after Vietnam, and he had come up with an ingenious scheme to turn the plane's GAU-8 Gatling gun, with its depleted uranium ammunition, into a portable, single-shot, long-range tank destroyer that the Mujahideen could carry with them on the ground. He was just one of the slew of enthusiasts who were offering ideas for doing in the Russians, and thanks to a call from Wilson, Dilger had been given a small development grant from the upgrade program. As chance would have it, Dilger had met Charlie Schnabel and Vaughn Forrest for lunch to rehearse the presentation he planned to give Wilson later that day. After several drinks, the exuberant inventor had insisted on showing off his wondrous device, which was in the back of his Dodge pickup truck. He boasted about its lethal characteristics, its ability to fire from a mile away and penetrate a 4-foot-thick concrete Russian fort or burst right through the armor of a tank. For some reason, he had loaded the huge gun with live ammunition, and it appears that it inadvertently fell when he left it propped up on a pedestal in the back of his truck at a gas station. Schnabel happened to be walking by that afternoon with a load of laundry when he heard the detonation. Dilger's demonstration had begun prematurely. The live shell had discharged and gone straight through a truck, two gas pumps, and into another car before the entire station went up in flames. Dilger, panicking, leapt into his pickup and fled the scene. The weapons manual, however, which he had just had translated into Pashtun, spilled from the back of the Dodge as he pulled away. Within minutes, the local news channels were reporting frightening alerts. Terrorists had just blown up a gas station at the edge of the nation's capital, and terrorist literature had been found in the wreckage. By the time Dilger came to his senses and returned to the gas station, the authorities were quite convinced that he was in fact a terrorist. That evening, Wilson and Schnabel would watch this weapons upgrade grantee on the local news programs, shielding his face as he left the Arlington courthouse. A sensitive and complicated set of negotiations followed. Dilger was forced to sell his house to cover his legal bills. Although he had been utterly irresponsible, the government had no choice but to assume responsibility for the damage, since weapons upgrade money had gone into developing the gun. The Pentagon paid off the two wounded bystanders. Schnabel's car was shrapneled, but he claimed nothing. Needless to say, the CIA chose not to buy the weapon. Miraculously, Wilson and the program managed to escape the scandal. Such minor setbacks aside, the program's return on the dollar was so high that it continues to this day, a testimony to how effective government can be without government rules and regulations. Some of the program's weapons, like the Texas chainsaw, were never used in Afghanistan. Prototypes were put through preliminary testing in Pakistan, and there were serious plans to kamikaze one into a Soviet IL-76, the world's largest plane, when it landed at Bagram Air Base loaded with Scud missiles near the end of the Soviet occupation. But ultimately, the seventh floor at Langley worried that if such a weapon was deployed, terrorists worldwide would discover how easy it is to build such delivery systems and turn them against the West. Much later, a version of the chainsaw did make an appearance in the Gulf War, and in that same campaign, the Charlie Horse II, a multi-barrel rocket that hurls so much ordnance of such diverse and devastating nature that it can literally wipe out everything moving along a huge perimeter, was also deployed. "My little babies were at play all over the Gulf," Charlie would say, beaming with paternal pride, when he discovered how effective his tiny $10 million a year research and development program had become. Back in the fall of 1985, Wilson listened to another of Vaughn Forrest's grandiose schemes, and, like a genie granting wishes, he turned to the appropriations well to make this one come true as well. The Knight of Malta explained that on his visits to the refugee camps and on treks inside the war zone, he had seen that the Mujahideen and their families were in desperate need of almost everything: boots, tents, sleeping blankets, medicine, canteens, winter coats, cooking utensils. You name it, they needed it, and the irony was that the U.S. military had vast stores of these very goods that they had long ago designated surplus and that were wasting away in warehouses. Forrest had looked into the law and discovered that the Pentagon could give away as much of this surplus as it liked, just so long as the gift was for humanitarian assistance. The next challenge was finding a way to transport the goods to Afghanistan, and that's where Forrest came up with a truly innovative proposition. Each month, he told Wilson, U.S. Air Force Reserve pilots spent hours flying huge, empty C-5A transports in continental-length circles to maintain their flight proficiency. Why not have them fill the C-5s with surplus and task the reserve pilots and navigators to put in their time flying humanitarian aid shipments to Pakistan? It wouldn't cost the U.S. government much of anything. This time, Wilson called on his Foreign Operations Subcommittee to insert an extra $10 million into the State Department's open budget to fund the program. Forrest had appealed to Charlie to name the flights after his then little-known boss, Congressman Bill McCollum. Such gestures are the way passionate aides like Vaughn Forrest manage to win a free hand to operate in their congressman's name. Officially, the McCollum flights were part of an open U.S. humanitarian mission, but there was nothing remotely open about the way they operated. In fact, the Pakistanis originally balked at letting the flights in at all. Wilson used his influence with Zia and won clearance, but only with very severe restrictions. The C-5s were required to land in the middle of the night and be gone before sunrise. For the uninitiated, the stealth-like arrival of a McCollum flight was an eerie and impressive experience. From the moment a giant C-5A cargo plane started circling the military airfield in Islamabad, waiting for darkness to fall. Landing without lights, the plane became a growing shadow as it approached the group of Pakistanis and Americans clustered by the runway. Then light suddenly poured out as the back of the plane began to open, revealing a hold half the length of a football field, able to transport over a 250,000 pounds of supplies. It was a scene out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The behemoth's hydraulic lifts began to hiss, and miraculously the beast knelt down as a colossal ramp was lowered to the runway, where young American airmen supervised the unloading of what appeared to be a city's worth of sleeping bags, boots, field hospitals, medicines, uniforms, binoculars, and body bags. The entire show, from touchdown to takeoff, was run by the ISI. It was never easy for the U.S. Embassy to figure out exactly which of these American night visitors fell into the McCollum category and which might be carrying a load of SA-7s for the CIA. On more than one occasion, the wrong U.S. agency would be on hand to greet and unload the plane. By the war's end, the quantity and variety of surplus goods flown into Pakistan was breathtaking, literally tens of thousands of tons. But almost as distinctive was the way Schnabel managed to commandeer the McCollum flights as his private airline. He went to Pakistan 12 times, perhaps more than any other Washington official. Without it, he never would have become a force in his own right. A McCollum flight took 2 full days, with a stop in Turkey or Saudi Arabia. And each time this other Charlie took the trip, his stature with the CIA station, the ISI, the U.S. Embassy, and the Afghan commanders grew. Schnabel not only used the McCollum program to smuggle sniper sights and walkie-talkies to Pakistan. Coming back, he would bring Afghan rugs and fur coats for the Angels, and a constant flow of captured Red Army memorabilia for the boss and his friends. He remembers one flight when he smuggled 3 Kalashnikovs, 2,000 rounds of ammunition, 3 rifle grenades, and a Tokarev pistol, all rolled up in 2 carpets. Schnabel never mounted a McCollum flight without packing a surprise. One C-5 carried thousands of fruit trees, which were then moved down the Grand Trunk Highway in trucks to the northwest frontier to be smuggled over the border to start reforesting the scorched earth of the war zone. On another trip, he brought along 2 of the weapons upgraders, demolition experts who trained Navy SEALs in their dark arts. To a certain kind of American, there was nothing so romantic and exciting as this war against the evil empire. And these 2 were so eager to get their hands dirty helping the Mujahideen kill Russians that they spent their 2-week vacation with Schnabel teaching his friends how to make the most deadly pipe bombs and booby traps. Schnabel managed to turn all of this crusading into enormous fun. The flights would take him to the Karakoram Highway, the old silk route he'd traveled when hunting for the great curve-horned, nearly extinct Marco Polo sheep. He also arranged to have one of his Texas patrons donate 60 black buck to replenish the dwindling herd of the same breed that the war was wiping out. Somehow Schnabel managed to convince the McCollum flight authorities that such cargo fit into the broad category of humanitarian assistance.